Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. A new database takes a look at domestic terrorism, and we're going to be talking with two journalists this hour from the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Investigative Fund. The piece is titled, Home is Where the Hate Is. Trump's fixation on demonizing Islam hides true homegrown U.S. terror threat. Our guests have documented that far-right episodes of violent extremism are far more common than Islamic domestic terrorism. A database of 9 years of domestic terrorism incidents compiled by the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute and Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting has produced a very different picture of the threat than that advanced by the current White House. We have two guests with us during the course of this hour, starting with Steve Alcorn, a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and Public Radio Exchange. And later, David Neuert will be joining us, a freelance journalist based in Seattle who helped compile the database for the Investigative Fund. And we'll start with Stan. Stan, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, you read from the incidents on the database and the number of domestic terrorism incidents far surpasses those of foreign Islamist terrorists. It's really remarkable to think about how much the focus has been on what the president has called radical Islamist terrorism when a good deal of focus should be on what's going on in the United States, particularly with alt-right groups.
Yeah, I mean, we found that the domestic terrorist attacks or incidents from right-wing extremists, there were almost twice as many as people who committed some kind of terrorist act or plot in the name of Islam. So, yeah, it's a stark thing that you can only really see when you have that data, which doesn't exist. The government doesn't actually track this very accurately. So it's up to people like David Neuert and his team at the Investigative Fund to really put together this picture.
Found that during this period of 2008 to 2016, right-wing extremists had nearly twice as many incidents, 115 incidents, just over a third of those, 35%, were foiled plots. When it comes to acts of foreign terrorism, Islamic domestic terrorism, what kinds of numbers were you looking at?
Well, so to be clear, both on the right-wing side and the inspired by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, things like that, what we were looking at, they're all domestic in the sense that the plans were hatched here in the United States, because there actually haven't really been any truly significant foreign terrorist attacks here in the United States over this period of time. But among those that were not the mostly white right-wing folks, the people who were often inspired by ideas that might have come from another country, committed in some kind of connection with Islam, I think there was a total of 60-some events. And we shouldn't diminish those. If you look at the totals actually killed, there were actually slightly fewer killed in right-wing terrorist attacks, 90 killed by people in the name of Islam compared to 79 on the right-wing side, though that's mostly because of the 49 people who were killed at the Pulse nightclub a little over a year ago.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the president's statements, his policies, and his personnel, that he has exhibited an obsession with the Islamic threat to the homeland. How so, and why, do you think?
Well, the why question is a tricky one to answer, but I think it's in the environment that we're in. We kind of it's not just the president. I think that it's something that we see in the media and in the past administration as well. This database covered the years 2008 to 2016. So while it's I think particularly relevant under the new administration, the pattern that we found also existed under the Obama administration. But you see that focus if you just look at things like sentencing, if you look at the amount of resources put in to these cases, because that's another big thing that we looked at with this database, is not just how many cases have there been, but what kind of cases? How are they treated by the criminal justice system? How many resources from the FBI are put into these right-wing cases compared to the terrorist incidents committed in the name of Islam. And so just to pick out one of the many statistics you could look at that tell you something about that, 48% of the terrorist incidents committed in the name of Islam involved sting operations. That's more than four times the proportion of far-right or far-left terrorist incidents. Only 12% of right-wing incidents involved a sting operation. So that's an operation that requires a lot of resources, where you get people who are posing undercover to try to reel someone in. And it's not a tactic that's used very much against the right wing. So that's one index of how the resources don't seem to line up with the threat.
And give us an example of that. Why not choose the one, I believe he was a Somalian who came to the country when he was very, very young and started espousing some radical kind of ideology, but it was a sting operation that landed him. Was that in Oregon?
Yeah, that's right. This is the case of Mohammed Osman Mohamud. What happened was, at this Christmas tree lighting ceremony back in 2010, there was this big kind of theatrical arrest that was on all the headlines, where the FBI has foiled a bomb plot, someone trying to set off a car bomb at the Christmas tree lighting. But what came out over the course of the criminal proceedings were that a lot of facts that threw a kind of a different light on that, because the FBI had, in a sense, it kind of foiled its own plot. They'd provided the fake bomb and the van. They'd driven the van. The genesis of the plot was not documented because the FBI said the recorder's battery had failed at the first meeting with Mohammed. And even just about a month before the Christmas tree lighting ceremony, the FBI itself said that they didn't think Mohammed would make any attempts to conduct a terrorist attack without specific direction from the undercovers. So it's one of these sting cases that initially looks like, wow, foiled plot, a substantial terrorist attack has been avoided. But then as the facts come out, it becomes a little less clear. It starts to look like there wasn't such a threat after all.
Mm-hmm. And then you talk about 2 days later, another young Oregon man, Cody Seth Crawford, launched homemade firebomb into offices of the Islamic Center in Corvallis. How much attention did that receive?
Yeah, so it was just the night after, actually. There's an arson at the mosque where Muhammad sometimes prayed, and it did get a lot of attention initially locally. It was not, I think, quite as big of a national story, and it did fade fairly quickly. It did get a lot of attention locally, but one of the reasons why we focused on it was that it was also treated very differently by the criminal justice system. Now, of course, it's a very different kind of thing, damage to property compared to a plot that, were it real, would hurt lots of people. But on the flip side, it was also an actual completed attack. This was a real fire, not just a fake bomb. And he didn't get any prison time, whereas Mohammed Osman Mohamud received a sentence of 30 years and a lifetime of supervised release, so that even when he's out of prison, he'll need permission from a probation officer even to use a computer.
Muslims, you write, are taken quite seriously as potential perpetrators, but far less so as victims.
Yeah, and that case exemplifies that. You know, at the mosque arson, the prosecution, the sentencing guidelines suggested he should have gotten prison time, and the prosecution decided to go more lenient on him and not to seek any prison time. And we do see in general this pattern where when the victims of a terrorist attack are Muslim, as in the case of this mosque arson, the prison sentences tend to be substantially lower than if the victim is the general public or a church and synagogue. I think it's a little bit more than half as long the prison sentences are when the victims are Muslim.
Mm-hmm. You also cite so many instances of right-wing domestic terrorism in this article, and some of them I've forgotten about, but you go on and on with a number of lists here. Please draw our attention to the rampage in Las Vegas, the Patriot Movement extremists Jared and Amanda Miller, and how police knew about their behavior long before this happened, and they were, you know, warned, but nobody kept a very, very close eye on this group. Can you tell us what their story was, and if there are many similar incidents of domestic alt-right terrorism?
Sure. And when David Nywert joins us, he'll be able to really explain this in depth because he's covered this for decades and covered a lot of these incidents. But we did think it was really important to talk about the flip side of all of the foiled plots you see on the side of the terrorism committed in the name of Islam. Most of those cases are foiled plots, whereas on the right-wing cases, the plots usually don't get foiled. The vast majority of those are completed terrorist attacks. And the Jared and Amanda Miller case is one of those. This couple went out and killed two police officers as well as another civilian. And in the time leading up to that attack, they were making threats on television, wielding a gun. Jared Miller was, even though he was a felon and that was illegal, and law enforcement could have gone in and arrested him then. They actually even left a voicemail where they threatened to start shooting if people came to arrest them. So there were all of these breadcrumbs, which admittedly you see more in hindsight, and it's very hard to know for any single incident if it could have been prevented. But certainly, you know, if they were talking about jihad and they were Muslim, it, certainly the experts we talked to think they would have been treated very differently.
There are some remarkable numbers here. The Southern Poverty Law Center, you see in the article, which tracks and has for years extremist groups in this country, had noticed that groups from the far right had collapsed in large measure after 9/11, but an explosion of patriot groups like the aforementioned one that began in 2009, the first year of Obama's presidency, reached a peak in 2012. The group counted 1,360 active patriot groups. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. And I think this was a big reason for the genesis of this whole project. David Nywert, who helped put together the database, just started to notice what seemed like an uptick and a return to some of what we'd seen during the 90s around the year 2008. And so he started to just keep this list, and it really verified, I think, his instinct that, yeah, the group counts were going up and the incidents were going up, and there was a reemerging right-wing threat that we need to be taking more seriously.
And where is that threat now? Do we still have it, Stan?
Well, you know, I focused a lot on a couple of particular cases that I went into the most depth on. So what I know about the right-wing threat as it exists now is a lot through the work of others. But I think every indication is that it's really substantial. I mean, we talked to Daryl Johnson, who was a senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, who was focused specifically on tracking the right-wing threat, and in fact sort of sounded the alarm back in 2009. And he says that actually, surprisingly, you usually see an emergence of right-wing groups and right-wing extremism under a Democratic president. There's that kind of reaction, feeling like you're not part of the government, and so you're not in power, and in reaction there's an emergence of more extremism. But that now under President Trump, he said we see something that he hadn't seen in his career, which is an increasing number of right-wing incidents, terrorist incidents, right-wing extremist groups under a Republican administration. So certainly he thought that we need to be taking the right-wing threat more seriously than the government seems to be.
He's not getting the resources he needs to confront that threat, is he?
Well, he's no longer at the Department of Homeland Security, but he also said that, yeah, his office that he ran has been dissolved. And so he's certainly concerned that there aren't enough resources going towards looking at right-wing extremism.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. We're still trying to reach David, who did the database. He's evidently on a delayed airplane, so we hope he will join us during the course of this hour, but we are trying to track him down. In the meantime, Stan Elkhorn will remain with us, and we're talking about a very, very exhaustive piece and interesting piece of journalism. Home is where the hate is. Trump's fixation on demonizing Islam hides true homegrown U.S. terror threat. And it really highlights and goes case by case of the number of domestic threats from the alt-right there have been from 2006 until 2016 in the country, and yet the administration really focuses on what they call radical Islamic terrorism. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We always like to receive your messages there, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Welcoming phone calls this hour, 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Willem in Colfax first. Hi, Willem.
Hello.
Hi.
I guess I'm not surprised by this, considering the Attorney General and the President and their sources of information tend to be Rush Limbaugh, Breitbart News, and that InfoWars show, and especially with Steve Bannon being an advisor to the President and having received an ethics waiver to still be involved with Breitbart News while he's advising the President. I'm not surprised that this is being neglected, and the President is supposed to, one of his chief duties is to keep the American people safe, so in not addressing this and also denying the threat of the Russian hacking in our democratic process, I think that it sort of constitutes a dereliction of duty on the President's part to basically ignore these facts and not address them. And I think the Attorney General's part of that also.
David, or Stan, what do you say?
Well, I think leadership from the top is really important. Everyone we talked to said that the President really does set the tone. One thing to think about, at least in terms of the investigation of domestic terrorism, is the FBI. They're really the primary agency involved here, and they are independent. And so there is a degree to which the FBI's decisions about, okay, how do we make cases, who do we go after, there may be some separation there from the some of the figures who he mentioned. So maybe that provides some comfort, but it's still really important.
Is the President still, you start the article by talking about his February 28th speech, first address to Congress. Midway through the speech, he turns to national security and talks about radical Islamic terrorism. It's a phrase he's used again and again. He gets a standing ovation from his supporters on this, and he excoriates people for not using that particular threat. Do a lot of people really believe now that most of the incidents, most of the threat is coming from the people that he's talking about? Do people have an understanding, or is it just his bully puppet is so big, he's President of the United States, that people will tend to believe what he says?
Well, I don't have kind of poll data in front of me, but my sense is that even before Trump was elected, a lot of people would say, hey, the gravest terrorist threat comes from Muslims, and perhaps it does come from overseas. And I think that's a picture that's reinforced often in the media. And also some of it has to do with terrorist attacks that are not occurring here in the United States. I mean, we shouldn't diminish the seriousness of attacks that have occurred in Europe and in the Middle East. I mean, certainly if you look outside of our borders, the picture would look a little bit different. But I don't think we can blame everything just on Trump and his bully pulpit. And certainly the fact that our whole database and what we found occurred under the Obama administration, I think, is another reason to suggest it's deeper than just one figure.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you look back at long before the 9/11 attacks, you remind us of the worst terrorist attack on American soil at the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, where a number of people were killed, and these were radical right-wing terrorists, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. Was there a great response to the possibility of domestic terror in those years, or do you think that it was ignored then as well?
You know, that's a great question. I haven't looked at much as much at that time as David Nywert, who I worked with, has. But I do think that we're really influenced by the most recent news events.
Right.
So 9/11 obviously changed everything, but each attack really, I think, has the potential to change the tenor of our discussions around terrorism.
And let's go next to Willem. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Paul in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Hi. You mentioned the enormous amount of resources that go into these sting operations, and a concern I've heard and wanted to bring up is that those resources are not both quote-unquote foreign terrorism versus domestic, but resources that go to stinging somebody who maybe is not a threat without the without the external motivation. Those are resources that can't go toward other law enforcement, whether it's domestic terrorism or more generally. My understanding is that, for example, in the FBI, an enormous amount of their resources have been turned from traditional law enforcement, including controlling things like white-collar crime and other serious crime, over to terrorism. So we have a big shift in what the focus, you know, what law enforcement is really focusing on these days. And even, for example, there's also the problem of coordination and what you pay attention to. Like in the recent Manchester bombing, they pointed out that this, although that's overseas, not here, that, you know, the person involved was well known. So you have to ask, well, you know, are you, if you're collecting all this data and running these big programs, is that really solving the problem, or are you dropping the ball on actually effectively dealing with the data you have? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Stan.
Yeah, no, I think that's really the flip side of these cases, like the Mohammed Osman Mohamud sting case in Portland that I was talking about earlier. You have an enormous number of agents who are working on this case, doing surveillance, people who are looking to make cases like this. You have to think about how that cases like that make us safer, not just in terms of would somebody like Mohammed Osman Mohamud, would this kid have actually gone on to commit any kind of terrorist attack. You also have to think about, are we made safer when dozens of FBI agents are spending their time on that instead of on something else? So the resource issue, it's often not at the forefront of people's minds, but I think it's hugely important.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, Michael. Hello. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, this whole notion of what is a terrorist act and what is not, based on whether a person is white or not, it came about in the 1980s, I believe. It was a conscious effort by the Republican Party with their mouthpieces in the media to never portray white supremacists as terrorists. I can't remember the article that I read. And you may have had the guest on at some point regarding this matter. And I just point to the Sikh Temple Act that happened in Cudahy.
Mm-hmm.
And how the media said it was a white supremacist, but never wholeheartedly mentioned that this person had a specific ideology against you know, certain religions. And then that would be more complying with the notion of terrorism rather than simply a violent act as it was portrayed in the media. And I'd like to hear what your expert has to say about that. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Stan.
Yeah, well, so the definition that we used to define terrorism is the one that's officially, it's in the Federal Register, is officially what the FBI uses, and it is itself ideologically neutral, and so that's why our database covers all ideologies. But when you look to things like terrorism charges, how many cases are actually prosecuted, and there's a weapon of mass destruction charge or a terrorism sentencing enhancement, you do see that those are used overwhelmingly in cases involving people committing terrorism in the name of Islam, some over 80% of those cases in our database, whereas for the right-wing cases, it's I believe it's somewhere less than 10%. So there on the one hand is an ideologically neutral definition of terrorism that's on the books, but when it comes to how we actually prosecute these cases in the criminal justice system, it does seem like right-wing terror often does not it's not treated like terrorism when it comes to the prosecutions.
What is the correct phrase? What should we be saying? Should we call it right-wing terrorism?
I think, yeah, when there is terrorism and it's committed by someone on the right-wing side, we should call it terrorism. I think it's really important that we do apply these terms to people regardless of the ideology. Terrorism is a tactic. It's a method. It's not an ideology. It's about committing or attempting to commit violence for an ideological reason to try to coerce or intimidate a larger population. So you can do that as a neo-Nazi. You can do that because you love ISIS. You can do that because you're left-wing and you're an eco-terrorist. And I think that to the degree that we in the media, we in civil society, don't use the terrorism word equally for people with different ideological backgrounds, we distort people's view of what terrorism really is and what the terrorist threat really is.
Mm-hmm. We heard the phrase left-wing terrorism with the shooting at the baseball field of Republican members of Congress in Virginia a few weeks back. Was that a correct term?
You know, I haven't looked into that case quite enough to know. One of the tricky things is intent is involved. You need an ideological motivation. You need to be trying to intimidate or coerce. So the act itself doesn't always tell you whether something is terrorism. And that's why for the database we had to really go and try to find the original police reports, really look into each of these events, because some things might look like terrorism on their face and then they turn out not to be, just because their motivations are not terroristic, essentially.
And let's go to Ivy next in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. Well, first I want to say I remember Oklahoma City, and everybody thought they were Muslims at first. But I wanted to bring up the case of the Bundy family in eastern Oregon. First there were two incidents when they took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and they were armed. And the other one is when the Bundys, who had not paid his cattle grazing fees for many, many years while all his neighbors did, the BLM went in to round up their cattle, and armed men stood over those BLM federal employees threatening to shoot them. And I don't understand how that could happen. And you know, that refuge is very dear to a lot of people, and they caused a great deal of damage and threatened people with guns. And if I wanted to go visit this refuge, which belongs to me, I couldn't go because it would be too frightening to be around people that are willing, as they said, to fight and shoot. So where does that fall in this? Thank you.
Thank you, Ivy.
Yeah, well, and the Malheur occupation is one of the four cases in our database in Oregon. We did find that it meets the definition of terrorism. I think one interesting thing to note about that case is, of course, you had all the not guilty verdicts at trial. So what that points out to me, one can quibble with, oh, did the prosecution make mistakes? But I think it's certainly suggestive that part of this disparity that we see, it's not just all on the government. It's not just all on people who are making decisions in the Department of Justice or at the FBI. It's also just about our entire culture. If you can't get guilty verdicts for right-wing terrorists at trial, then you don't try to make those cases. You know, on the flip side, Mohammed Osman Mohamud, despite all the things that I mentioned about this case, where this is a sting case of a kid who the FBI itself said he wouldn't have committed a terrorist attack without the undercover agents, they didn't have trouble having him found guilty and getting him a 30-year sentence. In fact, I talked to one of the jurors who told me she was one of only three jurors who was even on the fence. Most of them thought immediately, no, he's guilty, because you know, this, it goes deeper than just the facts of the individual case. People bring all of their own baggage to how they look at these things, and that includes the people in the jury, as well as the prosecutors, as well as people in the government.
Tell me where this is at this point. You write in the article that far-right extremists have been increasing the recruitment of members of the military and experienced veterans who would have the skills to execute them, like McVeigh and like Rudolph. We haven't talked about him, both military vets. Is that still going on? Did they recruit a lot of former military?
You know, I'm not sure about that. That's something I haven't personally done reporting on. I know that was something that that Gerald Johnson, I mentioned earlier, who we talked to, used to be at the Department of Homeland Security, was very concerned about back in 2009, but I'm not sure about that right now.
And what about Congress? Congress, the article says, has also played a role in pushing counterterrorism work to focus exclusively on the threat of radical Islamist ideology. I'm just wondering how extensive that is, if the work, if the money is going almost exclusively to radical Islamic terrorism.
Well, I mean, to point to Daryl Johnson again, I mean, one thing that he said is that the only real agency we have that's focusing on right-wing domestic terrorism is the FBI. So there are many other agencies that are working on foreign terrorism, but when it comes to domestic right-wing terrorism, they're kind of the only game in town. So to the extent that resources within the FBI are themselves not going to making right-wing cases, but are focusing more exclusively on, yes, what Trump calls radical Islamic terrorism, then I think that that is a reflection of that kind of resources that don't seem to line up with the threat.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. We're looking at a new database that suggests that most domestic terrorism from the past 9 years is homegrown and right-wing. And we have, as our guest, Stan Elkhorn, a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and Public Radio Exchange, and welcoming phone calls for him. Marty is next in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Reveal is a really terrific radio show. Thanks for producing that. The discussion so far has been, of course, very thoughtful and insightful, but I'm going to bring it down to something a little more basic and simplistic. I think we just still need to hate brown people in this country. Otherwise, we would be seeing these white men being called terrorists. My generalization about Trump supporters are that they are white men, and here you go. Here we've got, thank God, we've got some brown people we can hate and take out our aggressions upon.
A lot of white women voted for him, too, though, Marty.
Yeah, well, they're white.
Stan.
Well, yeah, I think that implicit bias is absolutely in the background of everything, right? And it goes from long before Trump, I think that that's been true. I think it kind of, some of this goes to what I was saying about the Malheur occupation compared to the Mahmoud trial, it's not just the FBI, it's not just the prosecution, it's voters, it's the people in the jury. If you find it very difficult to find that someone whose political views, they sound kind of like your political views, they're just a little bit more extreme, and they look like you, they have a background that's more familiar to you, maybe it's harder to find them guilty of something like terrorism. Whereas if somebody has a religion that isn't your religion, the skin color that isn't your skin color, maybe they're born somewhere else, in the case of Mohammed Osman Mahmoud, who came here as a three-year-old refugee, maybe it is easier then to think, yes, this person is dangerous. It's always tough to say with any individual case to what extent that bias is operative, but I think that the starkness of the numbers shows that this is a systematic problem, and so I think that that's absolutely, racism and bias are part of the picture there.
Mm-hmm. And you outline in the article, it doesn't look as though, just to let you know, that David is going to be joining us. I think he's on a plane somewhere trying to get into town, so the show is yours this hour. But some of the other incidents that took place, of course, we remember recently the horrendous killing in South Carolina at the African-American AME church. I wonder about those acts, if what you call those, and it seems as though all of those should have some kind of name because it was so horrendous and it was a race-based hate, horrible crime. You also write about police discovering Eric Charles Smith, who ran a white supremacist church out of his home. I'm not even sure where this was, and I hadn't even heard about this, who'd built a stockpile of some 20 homemade bombs.
Yeah, and these cases, I hadn't heard of that one either until David wrote about it. I think that is it's all part of the picture, right? There's a kind of vicious cycle where maybe these cases don't get quite as much media attention, so we don't think they exist. People are often really surprised, you know, when I'm telling them about the story and the fact that there are nearly twice as many right-wing terrorist incidents. They think, that can't be right. There must be something wrong with your definition. But when you start reading through the list, you see, no, these are legitimate incidents of terrorism. Just many of them don't get the same kind of national attention that something like the Mohammed Osman Mahmoud case gets. Mm-hmm. Something where you have a Muslim terrorist, they do tend to get more media attention, and so we're more aware of them.
And why does the press do that?
Well, again, I think it's all around us, right? I think that the media, the FBI, the government, we're all part of the same American culture, and so I don't think you can point to, hey, it's just this person or it's just this entity that is the cause of this. But I think they all reinforce one another. So I think that one thing that this database could do is help remind us that it's important to call terrorism terrorism when you see it, and to have that definition not be tilted by the ideology of the perpetrator.
We welcome our phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Stan Elkhorn is a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and Public Radio Exchange. And we're looking at this very exhaustive database that shows that domestic terrorism from the past 9 years is homegrown. It is right wing. And we're talking about the database and why it is that resources are going into a threat of, quote, Islamic terrorism, why those cases get much more press, even though the number of hate terrorism groups really dominated by right-wing organizations. So why don't we pay attention to that? And some of these cases we've never heard of, and they're alarming. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we do have David with us now, so you'll be happy to know that, Stan. David is with us. I think he was on a plane somewhere. David Nyard is a freelance journalist based in Seattle, and he helped compile the database for the Investigative Fund. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Were you on a plane? Were you on a plane somewhere?
No. I had to run a family emergency.
I hope everything's okay.
Yeah,
okay?
It's all good.
Okay, good. Everything's good. So we don't have a whole lot of time, but tell us what's on that database. What's amazing to me, and we were talking about this with Stan, were all these incidents that simply were not publicized very much. There were many of them, and they were very alarming.
Yeah, it's very. It's actually one of the frustrations as somebody who actually covers this stuff. Is we'll blow these we'll blow up a case of a Muslim with a knife into an act of terrorism, and yet somebody will wander through a crowd shouting white power and killing people, and nobody pays any attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Except, local news. It happens on the local news, but does your major media pick it up? Hardly ever.
Why?
We apparently have conditioned ourselves, well, two reasons. There's the sort of conditioning, I think, that we've taken, to get to the point where we just don't see terrorism as being something that white people do, that white Americans do. And a lot of that has to do with the narrative that we're fed in the media. Why that happens in the media is hard to say, but I can say that, what happened to DHS back in 2009 with the release of that bulletin pointing out issues about the rise of right-wing extremism and how those people all lost their jobs and this unit was shut down. And it's still kind of a right-wing talking point that, the Obama administration was targeting veterans for profiling as terrorists, which is not what the bulletin said at all. But nonetheless, that had a huge effect on how it was handled, both within officialdom, that is by law enforcement, as well as politicians, as well as by the media. The message became loud and clear. If you report on right-wing extremism, terrorist acts of terrorism, you're going to get attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't do it anymore.
And how much does it have to do with the current administration? Has certainly, the president has talked about radical Islamic terrorism again and again, a focal point of his campaign, certainly, and attacking people who would not use that phrase.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's this idea that, I mean, what Trump is really kind of projecting is this idea that the only real threat to our society from terrorists is coming from Islamists. And that's just a lie. It's just a flat-out falsehood. And, you know, it's hard to reconcile with the facts. And so, you know, that's certainly one of the things that I think the database amply demonstrates, you know.
So how many incidents are on the database, David?
Oh, I think we have 215 total, or somewhere around there. We have about 116 cases of right-wing extremism and about 62 cases of Islamist extremism.
Mm-hmm.
That's over 8 years, from 2008 to 2016.
Mm-hmm. And as we were talking...
Or 9 years, I should say.
With Stan, some of those Islamist incidents were sting operations. Were they as well for the right-wing incidents, sting operations?
There were some, yes, but the proportion is really wildly different. Only 35% of the right-wing extremist cases involved, you know, preemptive arrests. 70% of the Islamist cases involved preemptive arrests. And in a lot of the cases, and really honestly, between 2008 and 2014 or 2013, the ratio wasn't even close. You know, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've actually had more actual terrorist acts from Islamists than we had in the previous 7 or 8. And so those have definitely altered the statistics a lot. But, you know, we were keeping track of this beginning in 2012, and I can tell you that about 2013 and 14, the numbers were heavily skewed in favor of, you know, in terms of right-wing extremists versus Islamists in terms of the actual deaths and injuries and real acts that were involved. So, you know, acts of violence. It was very heavily in the favor of right-wing extremists, mm-hmm. and it still is.
Mm-hmm. So what do both of you think, and we'll start with you, David, because we haven't had as much time with you. What do both of you think needs to be done to lessen the threat of terrorism, to lessen actual terrorist attacks, to bring attention to some of these groups that have been ignored? What needs to change?
Well, a lot of it just has to be awareness. A lot of it has to be with news judgment, with the way executive, you know, with the way producers and editors and people in the media judge these things. There needs to be an understanding that this has been terribly skewed, and it's up to the people in charge of dispensing our information to think, you know, to think through it and recognize what the problem is. But, you know, I bet Stan has some very good ideas as well.
Stan.
Well, I don't know. It's always difficult to tell a journalist to make decisions for government and other people like that. I tend to think of the things that we could change as journalists, and I think changing people's worldview is really important. Like I was saying earlier, in all of these issues about this sentencing disparities, about the disparities in how we prosecute people, they're also reflective of what prosecutors think they can convince juries of at trial, and those juries are watching the news like anybody else. So I do think that making people aware of the actual balance of threats on the right-wing side and across the ideological spectrum is really important. And it does seem striking, once you look at this database, it does make you think the government should really be thinking about how it uses its resources and do they line up with what the threat actually is. So I think that if hopefully information like this could change the minds of both regular people and people who are making decisions in the government.
Yes. Let's go to Ron in Sheboygan next. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for letting me on your show. There's two quick points. Like, one thing, like, no one ever actually defined the word, like, terrorism. Like, is Adam Lanza killing a bunch of little preschoolers, is that terrorism? or is, you know, like no one ever defines it. And, like, there's never any investigations of any of these attacks, like the one in San Bernardino, where, you know, a lot of witnesses said there were big men in, like, SWAT gear, like three big men, I think. And, you know, all we hear on the TV is, oh, it's these two Muslims, these little Indian or Pakistani couple, you know. Like, the media just gives one point of view, and that's anti-Islam point of view.
Who wants to respond?
Yeah, well, I think to some extent that's true, although, honestly, you know, I don't think that... I think everybody, whenever there's a terrorist act, especially like the scene at San Bernardino or things like that, there's always a lot of confusion and there's always a lot of wrong reporting that happens in the initial phases of those things. And so, you know, I learned long time ago to, you know, let the facts sift out before you actually jump to any conclusions on what the origins of these threats are. It's become, I think it's just become kind of reflexively easy for the media to just write these things up as Islamist attacks. And, you know, it becomes a self-reinforcing thing.
And I jump in and say, on the question of definition, this can be a very fraught discussion, but
yes,
there's a definition on the books that the government has, and that's the one that we used. And it's, you know, domestic terrorism involves acts dangerous to human life that are in violation of the criminal laws of the United States, that appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, or to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of government by mass destruction, assassin, or kidnapping. I believe that's the right definition. It's something along those lines. So there are ways to define it that are ideologically neutral, and certainly on different cases, people could have different opinions. What was their real intention? And for that, in the database, we turn to experts, to vet ones kind of on the edges. But for a lot of cases, there really should be no question. There are cases in this database and where if you just look at the words in that definition, you can't not think that it's terrorism, right, unless you have a view that only Muslims commit terrorism. There's plenty of right-wing terrorism if you just use an ideologically neutral definition.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie in Madison is next. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there, Kathleen, and hello to your guests. I tuned in a little bit late, but I listened to the Reveal documentary last night and heard the story about Mohammed, and I was angered and appalled. I would like to know their opinions. To me, it seemed like entrapment or borderline entrapment. This kid was, at least he was deeply vulnerable, and I thought it was so terribly unfair. And I'm gonna hang up and listen to your response, okay?
Thanks, Tiffany.
That's Stan's baby.
Stan, go ahead.
Well, yeah, thank you for listening. Yeah, I mean, the defense tried to mount an entrapment defense, as is often true in these sting cases, and that defense has never worked in these terrorism cases. They've not been able to convince a jury. They did find imperfect entrapment, which caused them to slightly lessen the sentence. He was actually looking at, I believe, like life in prison. He ended up with 30 years. This case is actually being appealed to the Supreme Court. They just filed their petition, I believe, last week. So it's not necessarily the end of the line as far as that legal process. It's ultimately, entrapment is a legal term of art, but it's also something you have to convince the jury of. And so even though you might think, hey, this seems like a clear-cut case of entrapment, in 13 days of trial, they were not able to convince the jury of that. And some of that, I think, goes to the fact that it's once you see somebody at the end of that road who's pushing the button, it becomes really hard, I think, to back up and say, well, was he predisposed to commit the crime? Because that's where you get into the definition of entrapment. Was he predisposed to blow up a car bomb at the time that the FBI first contacted him? And the defense would say absolutely not. The prosecution would say absolutely yes. But in any case, there's a lot of things that happen after that that I think understandably influence the views of the jury.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both very much for being with us. An interesting hour. Thanks. And thanks for doing the database. It's important. Thanks. Stan Alcorn. Yeah, you're welcome. Stan is a reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and Public Radio Exchange, PRX. David Nyert is a freelance journalist based in Seattle, and he helped compile the database for the investigative fund. The article is on our Facebook page in case you would like to read it, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks very much for all of your calls, for participating in this program. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this show, Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. We'll continue right after the news from National Public Radio.